Support comes from Aventiv Research. People who are 18 or older and haven't had a pneumococcal vaccine may qualify to participate in a clinical study to evaluate if an investigational vaccine helps to protect against pneumococcal disease. Learn more at AventivResearch.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After racist, anti-Semitic, white power graffiti was discovered in an Ohio State academic building recently, university officials were fast to say that the offending slurs had been quickly removed. But the trend of such behavior persists at Ohio State and other such academic bastions of free speech, even as institutionalized discrimination has faded over the decades. An Ohio State men's hockey player was levied a game misconduct penalty at Michigan State last week after an official heard him utter a racial slur at an MSU player. The Anti-Defamation League explains that racists and demagogues have exploited the free speech environment to tap into the nation's future leaders, still forming a sense of self and seeking their niche in the world. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is an associate professor of history at Ohio State, where he teaches about the civil rights and black power movements. He also is host of the Teaching Hard History podcast. We'll post a link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. Hassan, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Adam Lehman is president and CEO of Hillel International, the largest Jewish student organization in the world, with chapters at 550 colleges and universities, including Ohio State. Welcome, Adam Lehman.
Thank you so much, Ann. Delighted to be here.
Listeners, we invited a representative of the Ohio State administration to discuss this issue. A spokesperson said that the university was unable to make anyone available because of Thanksgiving week. He provided a copy of President Christina Johnson's message to all Ohio State students, faculty, and staff titled, What We Stand For. In the email, President Johnson condemned the racial slurs and anti-Semitic symbols, which campus police are investigating. So, Adam Lehman, one in three Jewish college students in the U.S. reported in a survey by Hillel and the Anti-Defamation League that they'd personally experienced anti-Semitism during the 2021 academic year. Can you give us a quick overview of what you're hearing from Hillel chapters across the country and internationally, for that matter?
Yeah, absolutely. And that study was meant to give us and others a clear data-driven read on what we knew was shifting in terms of marginalization and discrimination directed at Jewish students. It was very sobering to see that level emerge. And candidly, if we took a snapshot today, I think that number would be even higher. And so numerically, as you said, you're talking about one in three, which is probably trending higher in this moment. I think qualitatively, it's important also to convey, what does that look like and feel like if you're a Jewish student? You know, recently at Arizona State University, it was confronting a whole series of flyers stating that satanic Jews control the world. Kanye was right. At Michigan, you know, flyering, indicating every single aspect of the COVID agenda is Jewish. At UC Davis, banners sharing the Holocaust was an anti-white lie. And so all of these are in more graffiti or postering or the like, confronting Jewish students as they're going about their average day on campus. And then on top of that, you have other ways that students are being harassed or threatened just by virtue of their Jewish identity, you know, or their relationship back to Israel as a Jewish state. So it's a very troubling situation. As we know, it has translated into violence. Thankfully, that has been very intermittent in terms of actual physical assault on campus, but we don't have to look far in terms of where else that kind of hate and discrimination has led to, you know, multiple fatalities at the Tree of Life Synagogue, or sadly, and not to equate, because all these forms of discrimination are so problematic, but at the top of the hour, we heard, you know, this LGBTQ attack, which was so horrific, in Colorado Springs.
Right. I mean, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, you can't study one marginalized group without understanding the pattern among all of them, right? Or and the how they are victimized by this hate.
No, you certainly can't, and definitely not in the American context, because whether past or present, it is absolutely all connected. The targeting of Jews in America, the targeting of African Americans in America, the targeting of members of the LGBTQ community, QIA plus community in America. We've seen manifestations both in the past and in the present. The question becomes, when we see these upticks, we've never done away with it. It's just a matter of, you know, when do we see spikes? And when we see these surges, the question then becomes, why now? What's different now? What is animating? What is accelerating, in a different sense, these surges? And that's where we have to be serious about sort of the conversations that we're having publicly, what's permitted, what's being sort of amplified. And that is, I think, where we can get at sort of the root, at least for the contemporary, the momentary manifestations of this kind of hate.
Yeah, the animation of this, Adam Lehman, do you have a thought about that and what, you know, where we're at in time with all of this?
Yeah, I agree with Professor Jeffries that it is both critical to focus on what's animating, but also squirrely in terms of isolating. I think without question, you know, the broader trends in society around polarization and demonization of anyone who views life differently than you may, there's no question that's a factor here. And it's created a coarseness in our public dialogue, but that gets echoed on campus. As you said, as students are forming identity and just trying to figure out their own belief systems. You know, I think beyond that, clearly we've seen, you know, over the last several years, a liberation of white supremacy as a movement and a sense of permissiveness in terms of voicing, you know, those forms of discrimination. And I think that's also surfaced in other parts of our public dialogue, not to dwell on the Kanye West situation, but when, you know, celebrities or influencers of any category are out and again, feeling like they can voice hate, it just adds fuel to this fire and has real, as we know, consequences in terms of how it then impacts students.
Right. It may not it might not manifest on campus in quote unquote violence, but the message is getting out, right?
The message is certainly getting out, especially when you think when you connect it to social media. And understanding that youth and young people and college students and high school students who eventually become college students are very much engaged in social media. So in other words, they're having access, they're being exposure, right, to radicalizing ideas, racist ideas, anti-Semitic ideas. They're in circulation in their groups of communication. I would say, though, that the common thread between all of this is white nationalism, right? I mean, and who become the targets
white
of
Christian nationalism.
White Christian nationalism, yeah. Absolutely. In America, right? The specific form, mm-hmm. And who become the targets of that? They become the Jewish community. They become the African-American community. They become the immigrant Latino community. They become the LGBT. I mean, so we're all in this together when it comes to confronting the ways in which white Christian nationalism, you're absolutely right, is being centered in the politics of far too many people on the right side of the political spectrum.
Are we doing a good enough job understanding that it's a we thing again, or are we just as a society still kind of separating people out like we're wont to do? Adam Lehman?
Yeah, great question. I think it's a bifurcated answer. Yes, I would say Professor Jeffries articulated well that we do appreciate across minoritized communities the role that white Christian supremacy plays in fueling this fire of hate. So there, I think we understand the recognition. We see it. We saw it. You know, if you go back to, I don't want to say the flame that lit the fire here, but if you go back to the Charlottesville March and that, you know, horrible
unthinkable
cross-section, right? And the way that expressions of hate were combining racism, anti-Semitism, you know, homophobia and the like. So that's the easy part. I think where this gets more complicated is with each then minority group you can look at within, there's just more complexity because they all are then impacted by other forms of discrimination that actually go beyond, you know, the quote easy version, meaning it's not that we have an answer for it, but we can at least identify and all agree. Yeah, white supremacy is this big problem. But when you look at racism, when you look at, you know, the impacts on the Latino community, when you look at LGBTQ, and when you look at the Jewish community, we each then are subjected to other forms of challenge that sometimes are pitting these groups against one another. And then it gets really complicated.
And I mean, we could go on and on naming the groups. I mean, whenever you're an other, someone who's Chinese American or visiting here from China right now, they've gone through all kinds of harassment over the last 2.5-3 years because of COVID.
No, certainly. I mean, the rise of Asian hate and expressions of that.
Not that it's new,
not that it's new, but, you know, we're seeing a surge. I mean, we can't ignore the fact that we're seeing these surges. And the same thing, Islamophobia. I mean, we've been dealing with that in new ways for the last two decades since 9/11. I think, though, when, you know, again, the common thread, right? Part of this certainly is the white Christian nationalism. But I think we can't be afraid to name the politics of hate that we have been trading in, particularly on the right side of the political spectrum, for the last decade, if you will, decade plus since the you know, Barack Obama's election and birtherism, and it's just been building to and through the age of Donald Trump.
Yeah, Pete Buttigieg, of course, Secretary of Transportation, former mayor of a town in Indiana, South Bend, Indiana.
Notre Dame.
It just posted on Twitter today that if you're a politician and you have been, I'm paraphrasing, voicing anti-LGBTQ propaganda to further your career, you are absolutely part of this problem, and don't say you're not. He's calling it out, plain and simple. Maybe that's something we're not very good at doing. Maybe, you know, I kind of think when the graffiti first appeared on the wall at OSU, not that it's the first, but this recent spate, you know, I guess it's my nature as a journalist to go, wait a minute, try to put it into context. Does this matter? It always matters, right, Adam Lehman? I mean, every single time.
Yeah, no, every expression of this only, again, adds to the coarseness and adds to the sense of harassment and marginalization when you're on the other side of it. I don't want to lose in this thread, though, that we are doing many things right. I would say we are doing more things right at an academic level than maybe, you know, at the political level, where free speech gets even, again, thornier in terms of how you regulate and what you decide is okay and not okay. But I'll look at the Ohio State situation where, as you referenced, President Johnson was very quick and very vocal in terms of responding, and that administration has taken other steps to engage with minority communities and try to ensure that, you know, those issues are being addressed. So I don't want us to lose within, you know, within the mess of what is that broader political polarization and dialogue, that there are productive steps being taken even on campus.
You, in April, Hillel International and other organizations brought college and university leaders from across the U.S. to a 2-day summit to explore solutions. I don't know, are we talking about solutions or responses or what? Is there a solution?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think we have to bring it down to what we can do and what we can see does make a positive difference. And so that was the focus of what we talked about at this convening. You know, first of all, kudos to Ohio State University for sending a senior leader to that convening. We had 45 presidents and chancellors, all in that case, trying to better understand what is the nature of contemporary anti-Semitism, how does it manifest, and what can you do? And we know a few things do work. Again, it's critical that senior administrators speak out. There's no substitute for leadership at that level. That's obviously not sufficient, but it's a start. Number two, as it relates specifically to the Jewish community, you know, unfortunately, because people get tripped up by the question of when is anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism, and the like. Jewish students were often being told if they came to a bias reporting officer, sorry, that's not our, you know, department or category. So you need to address policy change and understand the student experience and ensure that students across the board are being heard in terms of those issues and that their concerns are being addressed. Number three, education, education, education. You know, universities are educational institutions. How do we make sure that students, faculty, staff, and leadership actually do understand these different branches of discrimination? And I appreciate where you guys went earlier. Right, you have Asian hate in there. You have Muslim hate in there. We have to actually start from the basics of what are these different experiences? What are the histories of these forms of bias and discrimination? And how do we all learn from one another and respect one another? And, you know, it sounds cliche, but it actually does work. We have seen, at least in the case of Jewish community concerns, where universities are engaging in that additional education, that Jewish students are feeling less marginalized and less subject to the hostility that, you know, they're otherwise seeing.
And I guess an important thing is to know that you have resources and places to go. There's a lot, big improvement over even the last 20 years.
No, absolutely. I mean, Ohio State has done a good job in the previous administrations with and the current administration with President Johnson. I mean, we know that her politics are right and her heart is in the right place. But at the same time, I don't think you can ever be too aggressive when confronting and speaking out and acting in response to these problems. I mean, one thing that we know in America is that this hate ain't going anywhere anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And so it's not enough to play defense. Mm-hmm. We do need to play offense because we know it's coming again to create exactly what Adam said, that kind of environment, that safe place for intellectual exchange of ideas. Because in the end, this is about educating students, about educating community, but it's about creating an environment for students to learn and excel, no matter who they are or where they come from or what their religious beliefs are, the racial and ethnic background is. It's about creating an environment so that they can be their best authentic selves.
Yeah, I also want to add, if I can, add one other dimension here, and couldn't agree more with the idea we have to figure out how to get on offense and actually be ambitious. You know, too often people are writing off the academic environment and saying, you know, lost cause for regardless of your political view, this issue or that issue. No, this is our best opportunity to shape young people and shape the future. So let's go on offense in terms of education and aspirations. At the same time, if we're clear-eyed, there is a defense part of this that matters too. Public safety, actually leveraging data, you know, and other ways to predict or try to predict where violence is going to come from. And this gets back to, quote, the easier part. Like, there's, we can track so much violent activity in society back to some of these white supremacist groups. And so let's just make sure we are doing everything we can at a video level, at a data analytics level, at a public security and safety level, to try to predict and certainly aggressively pursue when campuses are being penetrated.
We have to take a quick break, but I just want to suggest the idea that, you know, higher ed, as much as it's kind of getting bashed these days, not necessarily getting kids jobs and that sort of a thing, it is probably the last place, and when I think about it, where so many of them will be exposed to the diversity of a college campus, particularly at a Big Ten, and the inherent challenges of that. So it was where I was exposed to so many things growing up. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Anti-Semitic and racist graffiti turned up in an OSU building last week amid a wave of hate symbols and speech cropping up across college campuses. 733 hate groups are operating in the U.S., according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks such organizations. 20 of them are based in Ohio, but many hate mongers operate as free agents. Today, we're talking about the disturbing trend, the history and efforts to tamp it down, and the relationship all that has with our higher education community in the United States. Still with us, Adam Lehman, he's president and CEO of Hillel International. That's the largest Jewish student organization in the world with chapters at 550 colleges and universities, including OSU. And Hassan Kwame Jeffries, he's an associate professor of history at Ohio State, where he teaches courses on the civil rights movement and Black Power movement. He also is host of the Teaching Hard History podcast. Check it out. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So I left us with that thought that higher education and off air, Hassan Kwame Jeffries suggested, you know, that it's not just the last place a lot of people are exposed to the diversity, but also for a lot of people, it's the first place they're exposed to the diversity of a big, especially a Big Ten college campus. But something you said earlier, Adam Lehman, I wanted to pick up on, and that's about, you know, how we are trying to intellectually, you know, start to understand and frame these things and have good, solid intellectual conversations about it, which I, of course, that's my stock in trade. But to me, the hate is the manifestation of anti-intellectualism.
Right.
How do you...
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm just kind of wondering about your thoughts about that.
Yeah, it's... This comes back to... The trends towards polarization and demonization, which again are definitely a level up from the university. We see this across our society in the US right now and frankly globally, but it does penetrate down, meaning that on a university campus, it can feel like there's an intolerance if you don't see the world the same way as other students may see it. And that I would posit, at least from what we see, that that is actually not unique to one political perspective or another. That is a hardening within all political perspectives. I do, though, you know, because we're going to constantly, I think, come back to the challenges. I do want to also elevate both what's working and the opportunities. Students are being exposed to more diversity on more campuses than ever before. Right. And that's a function of university efforts to grow diversity and just changes in demographics. But that's a good thing. Right. That's the opportunity, which is students are being exposed. And there are so many students who both are able to benefit from more robust support for their specific identity, whatever that group may be. And I will tell you, like, there have never been better opportunities if you're a Jewish student on campus through Hillel, through other organizations, to explore your identity and really grow your leadership and serve the broader world. So that, and there are great opportunities to work across those groups. I would just say that sadly, because of those trends towards polarization, sometimes even if a Jewish student group is trying to reach out to other student groups, you run into barriers where people don't want to talk because they feel like, nope, we just see the world differently.
Hmm. Hassan, what about that?
Well, you know, some of that I think is a function of groups sort of in a defensive posture, in a defensive mode. I got enough stuff that I got to deal with right now, you know, internally in my survival. And certainly speaking, you know, it's a African-American and as a former Black student on these college campuses, it's like, man, I'm just trying to survive here mm-hmm. myself. But I think the critical point, and Adam, you make it well, is, you know, we're kind of all in this together. And we need to be reaching out. We need to have these internal dialogues. We need to be able to explore our individual identities and come into our own as young people in this particular moment when you have this opportunity on campus. But part of that, part of understanding who you are as a young person, as a maturing person, is understanding other people. You have to be in conversation, right, with people across, you know, different identities so you can better understand who you are. And, you know, Adam, you've also mentioned several times, and I think this is so critically important, the word dehumanization, right? Because that is we've seen that in the politics too much. And once you begin to do that, this is literally leads you down to that pit of violence. Because once you're able to cast people outside of the human family, right, once you're able to say that they are lesser than, then you wind up with something like what we saw in Pittsburgh, what we saw in more recently, just the other week, in Colorado Springs, right? When you don't see people as human beings, when you cast them out, not just as other people you can disagree with, but as people who fundamentally don't have a right to be here and their existence is a threat to you in some way, shape, or form, nothing comes of that but violence.
Yeah, and if I can, and I want to point to one other source of the problem and also one other solution. One other source of the problem, which may feel out of left field, but I believe it's true, is the rise of technology. Now, earlier in my career, I was part of the team that built up America Online and worked on all sorts of different new technology platforms, which have, I think, added a lot of value to the world, but they have also led us to fall into these little screens. And when you talk about dehumanization and just a lack of empathy, we know that technology, social media, and the like continue to add to that challenge. On the solution side, I do wonder, much like an ambition around, you know, getting to space in the 1960s, what does it look like for higher education to say, sure, we have to train students in terms of their employability for the future, and that means they have to learn X, Y, and Z, but we are also going to put a stake in the ground as a higher education system and say that dialogue across difference, understanding each other, is imperative to the future of education, but also the future of democracy. You know, I'd love to see us as a part of that solution, because I really do think it would make a difference.
I couldn't agree more, but I also think we have to recognize the real world obstacles that we're confronting on college and university campuses. For example, the Supreme Court right now about to do away. I mean, just the questioning that we saw in a recent case coming up around affirmative action, questioning the very value of diversity.
Yeah.
And in other ways, questioning others, questioning the value of democracy. And so, Adam, I am with you. I think these should be the places. We should put the flag in the ground and say we're going to build. But we do have these real world challenges that in doing that, we have to face and eventually hopefully overcome.
Right. I mean, this is not just some kind of abstract idea that they're talking about in the Supreme Court. These are actual policies at universities and colleges that they want to do away with, calling them unconstitutional.
Absolutely. And this is this rollback on diversity. Has been coming. We go back to the Grutter case in the early 2000s. And we know, for example, the number of African-American students at The Ohio State University main campus has decreased substantially over the last 10, 15 years.
Yep.
And so just at a time when we're seeing this uptick in hate, when we're saying, you know what, we got to double down on diversity, we got to double down on democracy, we're actually moving in a direction to make it harder for diverse communities to be a part of the university college environment.
And it almost feels systematic. Hassan, the Columbus Dispatch published a report today about an OSU men's hockey player who was levied a game misconduct penalty at Michigan State last week after an official heard him utter a racial slur at an MSU player. The MSU player, Jagger Joshua, complained on Twitter about the lack of quote-unquote public action by OSU and the Big Ten. The OSU player identified in the story as Kamil Sadloka has continued to play. How do instances like that, because this was at 4 o'clock in the morning when I'm reading this, and all of a sudden I went, what? This just happened. I hadn't heard anything about it. What's kind of lost opportunity, or what kind of opportunity is there for us?
Well, I just heard about it too. In Googling what was the graffiti at Ohio State, this pops up. And I'm like, right. Oh my goodness, how did I miss this? And I must say, I was, you know, when we, there are different manifestations of racism, different manifestations of hate. And the use of racial slurs is one manifestation of it. And, you know, our student athletes are our ambassadors, right, especially at Big Ten schools, large universities. And there should be no place for this. And it's not enough. I humbly submit. And I've worked on athletic council, and the people in the athletic department are wonderful people who are committed to creating inclusive, safe spaces. And I truly believe that. But there is, this is impermissible. And it's not enough to simply, you know, say this deserves an in-game penalty. I read the statement that was issued by the athletic department, and it was sort of legalese to the extreme. I get it. But more has to be done. A message has to be sent. If this is true, and it seems to be that this was the case, then this is wholly intolerable. I'm okay. You know, we know that our student athletes sign away particular rights, if you will, to be student athletes. And so our athletic departments have a lot of control over what is acceptable, what is permissible, what student athletes can and cannot do. And sometimes when you cross a line like this, in this particular environment, something much stronger than a penalty box assignment needs to be done.
Yeah. Adam Lehman, I'm not sure if you've heard about that incident, but.
Yeah, I'd love to comment on it. I could not agree more on the need for a clear message and consequence. And we had a similar situation with that has not been publicly disclosed. So I'm not going to share the university, but in the Northeast, same thing with student athletes directing. In this case, it was an anti-Jewish set of epithets. There has to be strong action. And I think we get ourselves confused sometimes in the university setting and more broadly when we say, well, free speech, you know, means that people do need to be able to say hateful things. And that's just the price of freedom and the First Amendment. No, it's not that simple. Campuses are institutions that can establish a campus climate and can establish some parameters. And I think this, we're talking again about some areas where it's hard to identify exact causes and solutions. This is a case where administrations have authority, they need to exercise it and establish a campus climate that's supportive and that does not tolerate these clear kinds of discriminations.
There is a place where people can report these incidents. It's called reportcampushate.org. I don't know who's behind that, but do those kinds of strategies, are those helpful where people can just vent or report?
I think, and I certainly will defer to Adam, but it's important. I think that is absolutely important to, like, we have the BART, you know, reporting on anti-bias and the like, or bias. You know, we have to report because we have to know, right? But there has to be follow-up, which usually there is at Ohio State. I must say they do a good job with that. But in addition to the follow-up, there have to be real-world consequences. Absolutely right. You know, the campus environment is a place for free speech, and we want that exchange of dialogue. But, you know, free speech does not go without consequences. You can say what you want, right? But when you cross that line, there have to be consequences for it. And sometimes we shy back on the consequences because we're worried, I think, sometimes as an institution about what the blowback might be for the institution as a whole.
Hmm. Yeah, that's right. Reportcampushate.org was a tool we created with the Anti-Defamation League and the Secure Community Network that was specific for just creating a more uniform anti-Semitism reporting tool. And it is valuable that, you know, for students to have these channels, but I think what Professor Jeffrey said is correct. There has to be actual consequence and action on the other side of it. In that ADL Hill survey you mentioned, we saw there was a 60% underreporting. So of all those students who reported experiencing anti-Semitism, 60% of them said, we don't even bother telling anyone because we don't think anyone is going to do anything about it. And that's an issue. But again, that's a solvable issue.
And I kind of think about the graffiti on the wall at Ohio State is one thing, but I would imagine the echo chamber of social media is much more insidious. and who knows what's going on there and what kids are looking at on their phone.
I mean, the echo chamber of social media, as you said, but also the microaggressions, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that often never get reported. The looks, the glances, what's said in campus, what's said in passing. I mean, we know that has been a problem for students of color, for non-Christians on college campuses, as long as we have had college campuses. So it doesn't surprise me at all that there would be underreporting across the board, and I'm sure it's across the board, because one of the things that students who exist in these communities have figured out to do is how to survive, right? And unfortunately, too often, that survival means, I'm just not even going to worry about it. I'm going to move on. I got bigger problems, bigger challenges to face.
Adam Lehman, we have to let you go. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
It was a real pleasure. And let's be hopeful. Together, we're going to find some solutions here.
Thank you. That's Adam Lehman. He's president and CEO of Hillel International. That's the largest Jewish student organization in the world. Chapters at 550 colleges and universities, including OSU. We're talking about all of this because anti-Semitic and racist graffiti turned up on an OSU building last week. That's amid a wave of hate symbols and speech cropping up on college campuses across the country. You can't talk about this too much. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. After the mass shooting at a Colorado Springs LGBTQ+ nightclub on Saturday, GLAAD President Sarah Kate Ellis told Good Morning America that anti-LGBTQ+ politicians and social media companies are amplifying hate.
Motive aside, I think what we're seeing is a 12-year high in hate crimes, 41% increase against the trans community alone.
The shooting, which claimed 5 lives and injured some 25 others, occurred amid a wave of hate symbols and speech cropping up on college campuses across the country, including at Ohio State. Still with us, Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an associate professor of history at OSU, where he teaches courses on the Civil Rights Movement and Black Power Movement. He is also the host of Teaching Hard History podcast, and we'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Joining us is Professor Jonathan Sarna. He teaches American Jewish history at Brandeis University, where he directs its Schusterman Center for Israel Studies. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Jonathan, 2 men were arrested this weekend in connection with a threat against a New York synagogue. Officials are weighing federal charges. How effectively, or what's your sense about how government officials and lawmakers and law enforcement respond to hate crimes like this, not just arresting people for it, but getting to the underlying issues that fuel it? We always, everybody wants to know why. What?
Well, it's mighty tough because, of course, hate speech is often protected by free speech. And when people are arrested before they commit a crime, that saves lives, but it turns out it's hard to convict. Juries say, but nothing happened. Maybe gave him the idea to do a crime. So there's this constant weighing up. Should we wait until something happens? Then it's a tragedy. But do we risk arresting someone before they act? And then not achieving a conviction.
After the shooting in Colorado Springs, we hear a lot about how law enforcement in Colorado, and I'm not going to target anyone particularly, but it's pretty common to say they are not going to enforce the red flag laws there. They're just not going to enforce it. Like, what if I just decided I wasn't going to pay attention to the red light? And blow through, what would be the consequences of that? And we were talking about consequences earlier, Jonathan Sarna. I mean, what about that? We've tried to institute this strategy of red flag laws in this country. what if the law enforcement doesn't want to enforce it?
It's a hugely difficult problem. Lots of district attorneys have found that when they brought these cases, people are not convicted. And so they don't want to bring them. And yet, it's horrific if we wait, as is so often suggested, until it's too late. And Colorado has seen what can happen. And many of those who have been arrested for planning synagogue bombings are similarly people who've long been known to law enforcement. So the sense is we should be watching people. But of course, even that is often opposed. Why are you looking at them? Doesn't that limit their freedom? And that's the problem we have if we, on the one hand, want a free society, and on the other hand, want to live safely without these kinds of hate crimes every other week.
Feels like it too. Hassan Kwame Jeffries.
And I think it's also important to point out that we do know, and the FBI, you know, take my word for it, you can take the word of the FBI, which I think a few people still respect, the penetration of white supremacist ideology, white Christian nationalist ideology into law enforcement. And so I don't necessarily think it is a coincidence that you have a reluctance on the part of some law enforcement agencies, not only and individuals, to enforce and uphold the law. When we know that they are problematic, they don't exist in a vacuum, that too often they are problematic in their actions anyway. And then when you combine that with then asking them to stop hate when too often they themselves are trafficking in it themselves.
Hmm. Of course, we know that at least in the case of anti-Semitism, and that's what the FBI meant last week when it said Jews are being attacked on all sides. It can come from the extreme right. It can come from the extreme left. It can come from radical Islamists. Those three groups don't agree on anything, but they all know that Jews are somehow at the root of all of the problems that they see in the world. And that's what's made anti-Semitism so difficult in our time, and why I think so many Jews are worried about it. You don't know which side it's coming from.
I'm kind of wondering about, you know, these issues of famous black people with a lot of agency, or so if we perceive them as having a lot of agency, using their platform to perpetuate a lot of the tropes about Jews in this country and the Jewish institutions in this country, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, and where the conflict is in the black community with that.
Well, I think, you know, anti-Semitism is an American problem.
Equal opportunity,
equal
hate,
opportunity,
right?
Yeah, and so it doesn't necessarily surprise me that we would see manifestations of it among people. It especially troubling when people have, within the African-American community, any community, have a platform to share these views. But I think it's a symptom of a much larger problem. And unfortunately, black folk aren't necessarily immune to it, just like we're not immune to having to be, you know, to harboring racist views ourselves. And so when we address the broader problem, I think we would find a positive impact on those manifestations within the African-American community itself.
And the broader problem.
The broader problem of hate, right? And saying whether it's sort of anti-Semitism or white supremacy, that we're not going to tolerate these kinds of politics. I mean, part of it is education, right? And just people not knowing. But it's often more than just ignorance, right? Some people, you can say, look, this person didn't know. They're just, you know, falling into these stereotypes. They've been bombarded with these issues. Like, okay. But sometimes it's people trafficking in it for particular political purposes. And they need to be called out for that, too. You definitely not just know better, but you're using this, the politics of hate, the politics of anti-Semitism, to make a particular point. And that, to me, is especially troubling and especially dangerous.
We hear a lot of references to dog whistles these days. It's not a new phrase, but we hear a lot of it. And dog whistles are a convenient way for people to cloak hate. They use different kinds of tropes and references. Jonathan Sarna, I mean, does it feel like, I'm trying to think what I would even compare this to, like constantly chasing our tail on this, that we can never get to the bottom of the lexicon of hate?
Well, I think it's really, certainly since Charlottesville, where you had white nationalists yelling, "Jews will not replace us." What was amazing there was that most Jews didn't even understand that was a dog whistle about white replacement theory and the idea that Jews are not only non-white, but are the most dangerous of all the groups because you can't distinguish them from whites. And in white nationalist circles, Jews are seen as imitation whites, and a lot of attention is paid to how to distinguish Jews from real Aryan whites. And since that time of Charlottesville, we've not only seen dog whistles, of course, we have seen horrific incidents beginning in Pittsburgh at the mass shooting at the synagogue there, and then continuing at a very broad clip, and only those that involve death tend to reach the national headlines. But on the local level, threats and injuries and the like have become all too common.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, your brother, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, representing the 8th Congressional District in Brooklyn, is about, we're pretty sure, to ascend to minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives in the wake of Nancy Pelosi. It's an incredible thing. It's an incredible honor. But there's a tax to pay on that.
There is a tax. We are excited as a family. And when it looked like Nancy Pelosi had announced, or when she announced that she was going to step down, I remember picking up my oldest daughter, Asha, who's 12, who hopped in the car, and I said, "Nancy Pelosi's stepping down." And she immediately knew what that could possibly mean, that Uncle Hakeem would rise in leadership. And her first response was, "Does that mean we're going to have to spend more time at Grandma's house?" And what she was referring to was us having to leave our home on January 6th because we were receiving death threats connected to my brother's, you know, political activism. And so, unfortunately, that tax in this partisan political environment means that we have to be careful. We have to be cautious. And unfortunately, that's a sad reality that we have to deal with. It doesn't mean we're going to shy away from it. It doesn't mean he's going to back away from it. It doesn't mean we're going to back away from it. But it does mean that we have to be cautious, and we really have some fighting to do.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, thank you so much for your time. As always, I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Anne.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries is an associate professor of history at Ohio State, where he teaches courses on the civil rights movement and black power movement. And you got to check out his podcast, Teaching Hard History. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Jonathan Sarna, professor of American Jewish history at Brandeis University, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure to have been with you.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.